Welcome once again to On the Brink Radio. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson, recording this once again from beautiful Takaka, New Zealand, here on Te Waipunamu, the South Island. Very, very, very magical place. In the 2 days in the future from now, which is 2 days in the past from when you're listening to this broadcast, if you're listening to it live on UCY TV, on the 15th of February, it'll be 20 years to the day since I first set foot both in New Zealand and in the Southern Hemisphere, leaving America out of Atlanta, Georgia on Valentine's Day 2000 and arriving in New Zealand. And I've hardly gone back to the Northern Hemisphere. I've been back to the Northern Hemisphere 3 times, and 2 times were in Hawaii, which isn't in the Northern Hemisphere by much. So I'm truly a Southern Hemisphere person. This show, broadcast number 311, it's called The Sacred Resilience of Life: Trauma, Transformation, Regeneration, and Rebirth. And it'll be scientific to a degree, but also quite philosophical and metaphysical. I'd like to open the show with reading some quotations from my very favorite of human scientists, authors, naturalists, Rachel Carson. These are some quotes from her book called The Edge of the Sea from 1955. Contemplating the teeming life of the shore, we have an uneasy sense of the communication of some universal truth that lies just beyond our grasp. What is the message signaled by the hordes of diatoms flashing their microscopic lights in the night sea? When we go down to the low tide line, we enter a world that is as old as the earth itself, the primeval meeting place of the elements of earth and water, a place of compromise and conflict and eternal change. For us as living creatures, it has special meaning as an area in or near which some entity that could be distinguished as life first drifted in shallow waters, reproducing, evolving, yielding that endless varied stream of living things that has surged through time and space to occupy the earth. To understand the shore, it is not enough to catalog its life. Understanding comes only when, standing on a beach, we can sense the long rhythms of earth and sea that sculpted its landforms and produced the rock and sand of which it is composed. When we can sense with the eye and ear of the mind the surge of life beating always at its shores, blindly, inexorably pressing for a foothold, true understanding demands intuitive comprehension of the whole, the marginal world. The edge of the sea is a strange and beautiful place. All through the long history of Earth, it has been an area of unrest where waves have broken heavily against the land, where the tides have pressed forward over the continents, receded, and then returned. The shore has a dual nature, changing with the swing of the tides, belonging now to the land, now to the sea. Only the most hardy and adaptable can survive in a region so mutable, yet the area between the tide lines is crowded with plants and animals. In this difficult world of the shore, life displays its enormous toughness and vitality by occupying almost every conceivable niche. The shore is an ancient world, for as long as there has been an earth and sea, there has been this place of the meeting of land and water. Yet it is a world that keeps alive the sense of continuing creation and of the relentless drive of life. Each time that I enter it, I gain some new awareness of its beauty and its deeper meanings, sensing that intricate fabric of life by which each creature is linked with another and each with its surroundings. There is a common thread that links these scenes and memories, the spectacle of life in all its varied manifestations as it has appeared, evolved, and sometimes died out. Underlying the beauty of the spectacle, there is meaning and significance. It is the elusiveness of that meaning that haunts us, that sends us again and again into the natural world where the key to the riddle is hidden. It sends us back to the edge of the sea, where the drama of life played its first scene on Earth and perhaps even its prelude, where the forces of evolution are at work, as they have been since the appearance of what we know as life, and where the spectacle of living creatures faced by the cosmic realities of their world is crystal clear. Then in my thoughts, these shores, so different in their nature and in the inhabitants they support, are made one by the unifying touch of the sea. For the differences I sense in this particular instant of time that is mine are but the differences of a moment, determined by our place in the stream of time and in the long rhythms of the sea. Once this rocky coast beneath me was a plain of sand, then the sea rose and found a new shoreline. And again in some shadowy future the surf will have ground these rocks to sand and will have returned the coast to its earlier state. And so in my mind's eye these coastal forms merge and blend and shifting, kaleidoscopic pattern in which there is no finality, no ultimate and fixed reality, earth becoming fluid as the sea itself. On all these shores there are echoes of past and future, of the flow of time, obliterating yet containing all that has gone before, of the sea's eternal rhythms, the tides, the beat of the surf, the pressing rivers of the currents, shaping, changing, dominating, of the stream of life, flowing as inexorably as any ocean current from past to unknown future. For as the shore configuration changes in the flow of time, the pattern of life changes, yet never static, never quite the same from year to year. Whenever the sea builds a new coast, waves of living creatures surge against it, seeking a foothold, establishing their colonies. And some come to perceive life as a force tangible as any of the physical realities of the sea, a force strong and purposeful, as incapable of being crushed or diverted from its ends as the rising tide. Beautiful, awe-inspiring words from Rachel Carson. I'm getting ready to ride my bicycle down to the ocean here in a few minutes and continue recording the second half of this show. But this show is in honor of life, and that's a pretty big topic, and it's really hard for us to get our minds around exactly what is life, because in our way of thinking we try to contrast what is life with, well, it's not life. And so the first thing that comes to my mind is that, you know, like machines, like tanks and bulldozers and guns and computers and stuff like that. That's not life. But to me, rocks and minerals are part of life. They're part of the body of Mother Earth. So I guess I'm wrong, because technically, these machines are made from substances that were alive as part of the body of Mother Earth. Well, I mean, like an animal is alive, but then if somebody kills it to eat it, it becomes dead. So they're not eating something that's alive, they're eating something that's dead. So is a machine made out of substances that used to be alive, but because they've been extracted and processed and changed and mutated, they're no longer alive. I mean, it's kind of a blurry area there, because it's the actual life force or energy, the chemical construction, the physiological, the enzymes and things like that in plants that give us their nutrition. So if a plant's totally dead, like if it's dried out and it's been laying in the sun for 2 weeks, but even then it might still have some nutritional value. So it's actually a really tough question to think about the distinction between life and non-life. But in terms of the individual person, we think of life as being people that are up and around and walking around. They may not necessarily be awake, but they're alive. They're breathing and excreting and eating, maybe reproducing or thinking about it, and all these different basic processes that we define as life. And so we don't really think of a brick as being alive, but, you know, so it's really hard. But I'm basically talking about, without trying to go too much off the deep end philosophically here, I'm talking about water-based life. I'm talking about organisms that are based on primarily water and carbon and a few other primary elements, and assembled and constructed on the orders of the master blueprint molecule DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. And again, this is a model that scientists' minds have constructed, the double helix of DNA. It's kind of like an abstract thing, you know, like it's kind of like the Big Bang, although that was something we placed in the indefinite past. DNA is supposedly, it's kind of like an atom. You know, they can split the atom and manipulate them and collide them and all this stuff, and they can manipulate DNA and take out bits and pieces and put in that and mix DNA from one creature to another and do all kinds of engineering techniques on it. But again, it's the empirical model that we've derived that allows us to do this. It doesn't mean that we actually understand the nature of what it is and what we're doing. We know that if we do this, it'll create that, or we believe that what we do might create certain effects, but we have no idea of other unknown, unsuspected, unwanted outcomes, synergistic things that happen. And this is for any endeavor at any type of discipline of scientific work. But the main theme of this show is how hardy and tough life is. You know, and I'll refer to her as she, Mother Earth, Mother Nature. They're all alive. But life herself is not really a particular being or artifact or organism. She's a force, a field, a process of living that isn't dependent on any particular species, any particular individuals. But I guess, like, materialistically, reductionistically, you could say that life is the multiple ways that DNA creates to make sure that it stays alive. And but it's almost like it's a lot more complex than that. There's a beauty, a highly astronomically improbable beauty to the inconceivably amazing life forms that are constantly created. And we know very little about even who's on the earth with us now, much less everybody that's existed before us. But you know, the standard consensus wisdom is that they say 99.9% of all life forms that have ever existed have gone extinct. And we're talking over billions of years. And so species might have lived for hundreds of millions of years, like the trilobites, for example. But this is so long. I mean, you know, a few hundred million years is really nothing. It's not very long in the time span of the Earth. And again, we're talking about this illusory concept called time, that along with space, it's really an artifact of our mind. It's really a map of our own consciousness that we're analyzing and studying, rather than the things themselves, which that lends a lot of further complexity to everything. But life is our family of beings. All the other species of life, all the kingdoms of life, the plants, the animals, I conclude the rocks and minerals and crystals, the algae, the fungi, the slime molds, even to me, water and the hydrosphere and the lithosphere and the atmosphere, the clouds, the volcanoes, the lava, the auroras, the currents of the ocean, the winds, the storms, the thunder and lightning, even the star nations, to me, this is all part of the livingness of the universe, the cosmos. But if we stay focused just on biological life, we believe that almost all of life that's ever existed has gone extinct. Yet, the Earth is extraordinarily densely populated with millions or billions or trillions of different varieties of life in all possible ecological niches. Astronomer Thomas Gold reckoned that the vast majority, at least equal to all the biomass of beings that are on the surface of the Earth and the air and the ocean, at least that much, if not more, biomass of everything that was alive was these subterranean microbes that lived down in the soil and even in the rocks, in the cracks between the rocks and in the rocks themselves, and that they're anaerobic, meaning they don't need oxygen, they don't need sunlight, they don't perform photosynthesis. They derive their energy from chemical processes down inside the rock. And beings like this could be found on places like Mars and the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, maybe the oceans of Uranus and Neptune. Very, very, very interesting. So, in terms of the mass extinction event hypothesis, which we're pretty sure something like that has happened numerous times, and probably many times, depending on the level of severity that you want to talk about. They talk about 5 major mass extinctions, which was believed to have reduced the total amount of life to a tiny fraction of what had been before. But many smaller ones that result in one of the immediate things of, say, for example, an impact from a comet or asteroid is the onset of relatively sudden global climate change in a true sense, that because of all the material spewed into the atmosphere, the smoke and the dust and the carbon and stuff like that, and maybe volcanic emissions, not even the toxicity of those, but their darkening of the sun and reflecting the sunlight and preventing the infrared energy to escape or allowing it to escape, all these different complex variables severely altered the climate of the Earth and cooled it down a lot, that made life difficult or impossible for a lot of life forms to, and this was something that wouldn't have had an instantaneous effect, that would have crept in over the next days, weeks, months, and years, decades, and centuries, as they found that they had less and less food, less and less places to go, temperatures were colder than they were used to. So this is part of the ongoing scenarios that life on Earth has survived and endured who knows how many times. So life can be reduced down to a very tiny fraction. We don't know how. I mean, we don't know if every single thing on Earth was completely dead except for like a handful of soil full of microbes. I personally believe that alone would have the ability to regenerate a whole planet of life forms, and who knows what it would be. Because to me, the creativity of life, DNA or whatever you want to call it, is sort of like a musical composition called a fantasia. As far as we know, Mother Nature never creates the same thing again. We don't know for sure, but in the same way we believe that every snowflake is different, every time new life forms are created, through however that happens, because it's quite unclear. Darwin could never really clarify where new species come from or even observed any that came into existence. But Emanuel Velikovsky, with his cataclysmic evolution hypothesis, seems to make a lot more sense, in the sense that life on Earth has been influenced through mutation induced by effects from cosmic encounters with comets and asteroids, or maybe passing through the tail of a comet, energetic bombardment from supernovas, cosmic rays. All of this is part of the cosmic context of life on the Earth. And so we've had bouts of sudden changes in life due to these catastrophic impacts. For example, and if you study geology, there's this big, big, big event called the Cambrian Explosion, which is where relatively suddenly, in geological time, which probably only means a few hundred million years or so, relatively suddenly, all kinds of new life just kind of seem to appear out of nowhere. Now, this could be an artifact of the way that we try to look at the fossil record, because it could be that through different factors and processes and reasons that whole significant layers or chunks of the fossil record are missing or don't exist or were never even created to begin with. So we see that. We don't see that as a gap in time. We just see what came next as if it was continuous, and we don't really know that for sure. But a lot of new life forms, and apparently when you start looking into it, a lot of new sort of basic designs for bodies were tried at the Cambrian Explosion, with different kinds of symmetry, different numbers of limbs, different kinds of things like that. And then most of them died out or didn't last that long. But the ones that we are, with the vertebrates, with a backbone and a head and 2 legs and 2 arms, that seems to be I mean, you know, we can't really understand the wisdom or the intelligence behind this, but it could be that that particular design worked better for the way the conditions were on the Earth from then on, you know, in terms of the gravity and the ratio of light and the climate and the composition of the atmosphere. And so life is continually not only adapting to and with conditions on the Earth, but interacting with the Earth and their environment in ways that are largely symbiotic. Some relationships are parasitic, if you look at the animal kingdom. It's so vast and so complex, and so it's like almost every possible combination of how to live and where to live and what to do and how to get around and how to reproduce and how to eat and who to eat and what and how much. It's like all of this is being constantly tried and experimented with, as if the consciousness of life is just the most ultimate artist in the universe, just only a notch down from the consciousness, the artist that's created the stars and the galaxies and the comets and the asteroids and the nebulae and the clusters and all that. And it's really all part of the same consciousness, of which we're a part, a tiny, tiny, tiny little drop of that cosmic creativity is our true birthright as the people of one heart. But life is very resilient. She's been able to withstand all kinds of horrible, catastrophic, nightmarish conditions on the Earth for so long. Heat, temperature, cold, dark, radiation. And she might have mutated, but she survived. And a technical question that I haven't found the right person to ask is, does DNA itself mutate? Does the DNA change? Well, I think I'm going to bicycle down to the ocean now and sit there with my little fluffies and some sand crabs and record the rest of the show and talk about the whales and dolphins as being guardians of water-based life on Mother Earth. And I'm going to sit right at that area where the ocean meets the land, that intertidal magic zone that Rachel Carson so eloquently just described in her words that I read. Now I'm sitting out at Rotati Beach. I'm about a meter from the edge of the river that goes right out into the ocean. So, and the river is flowing quite strongly out to the ocean. So I guess probably in about an hour it'll be low tide. Yesterday I was here right at low tide and walked all the way out to the breakers, probably about almost 2 kilometers. I don't know if you can hear it or not. There's a really loud, to me, compared to the silence of yesterday, there's a loud motor. It's probably some kind of fishing boat that's probably got to be at least 3 kilometers from me, but it's so loud. I mean, I can't imagine how loud it must be if you're actually on it, or how loud it must be to anything in the ocean, anywhere within a radius of 2 or 3 kilometers or more. Anyway, I'm in Rachel Carson's home territory, and whenever I'm in places like this, I really feel like that her spirit is with me. I've been so lucky to be able to come and spend some time here almost every single day. I can only think of 2 days that I haven't come here around sunset in the past 5 weeks. It's been so awesome. Have my swim. I think I'm not sure that pantheism is actually that you'd think of it as an organized religion in the sense of like Buddhism or Christianity. I don't think there's any pantheist temples or anything like that, because a pantheist temple would be nature herself. Anywhere out in nature, any sacred place, which is really everywhere. But I think I'm a pantheist. This guy in Tasmania told me that once, because I see the beauty and the sacredness in everything. And I think that just about everything is alive in its own kind of way. I hesitate to say that machines and things like that are alive. A bulldozer. We can attribute anything that we want in our mind, which is really what everything is. But water-based life, biological organisms, plants, animals, amoebas, things we just don't know about, and most of which have come and gone on the Earth long before us. We only know them through, well, we know them through our ancestral memory of our the consciousness of our DNA, because we sort of encode, in a way, probably everything that's come before. And what they say is ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. That was something we learned in biology. That means that the development of the individual organism sort of goes through stages that mimic or replicate the evolution of the whole species from the beginning. So we, the human embryo, goes through a stage that looks like a tadpole, and it has gill slits and maybe fins, or, you know, that kind of thing. But it's really, I think that it's all very much more complex than we're willing to give it credit for. We can only deal with so much in our mind. We create these maps and concepts, and then we're pretty much content to just sit back and deal with that, rather than to continually grapple with the fact that these are really just maps and concepts and not the reality itself. But it's very interesting thinking about, I spent a lot of time talking for this radio show and reaching a few people in a very high quality way to try to understand what it means to be here now as a human being. But the concept of on the brink has a lot to do with understanding the ephemerality of our existence, and also the sacredness of being here now, but also the desecration that our species has been so deeply committed to ever since the dawn of civilization, or civilizations, a theme I've talked about many, many times. But I love Mother Earth, and I really like the concept of Gaia, the Greek name for the Earth. James Lovelock is the scientist who, I think that his book about the Gaia hypothesis was really cool, about how, for example, the atmosphere exists in a state of thermodynamic and chemical disequilibrium, which is not really what happens in a mechanical system. Only living systems can maintain a constant state of disequilibrium thermodynamically. And so the Earth's constantly adjusting and replenishing, and it's alive. Like when people try to study the atmosphere and predict the weather, climate models and all that stuff, it doesn't even take into account that the Earth is a living being with literally a mind of her own that's far beyond. I mean, we think, oh yeah, the Earth, it's a planet, it's a ball of rock and some water. But I really think that it's a field of consciousness that we are a part of, and we experience and sort of know it, but we've blinded ourselves to its reality. But I really think that Gaia, you know, if we want to look at it as it's not an extraterrestrial intelligence, it's a terrestrial intelligence. Terrestrial meaning that's her, the Earth, the land, the planet. So she is an auto terrestrial intelligence, an ATI, auto-terrestrial intelligence, or maybe intra-terrestrial intelligence. And she loves us, but she's very confused and not happy with us. And I just was thinking today that Mother Earth and our fellow life forms are really confused about how to deal with us, because throughout most of our existence, we've been an integral, harmonious part of the family of life. We weren't a threat or an enemy or an invasive parasite or a danger to everybody else. We weren't the tyrants of the earth until very, very recently in our history. And so the tradition of all other life forms, including Mother Earth, relating to us has been as a well-loved member of the family, and we've just gone off the deep end. And so I think it's really hard for them to change their behavior towards us. It's hard for beings that are made exclusively really of love to actually have retribution and anger against us that is truly justified, because of the wanton destruction we just continue to wreak in every possible way. And so I think karmically, we are doing a lot to destroy ourselves, even though we are doing a lot to convince ourselves otherwise. But the reality is, we are wreaking major havoc ecologically in almost every possible way. Australia being a very, very, very prime, very sickening and sad example of that. Australia is a microcosm of Mother Earth. Very practically defenseless, because she didn't need defenses until the Europeans came. And so Mother Earth relates to us like that. We're one of her children, and she's having a hard time recognize us as the invasive viral parasite that we've become. And maybe she has seen this before and knows it's just a passing phase. But there's going to come a time when the healing process is going to have to get a foothold, and she's probably going to send out something like white blood cells, but at a different level, to get rid of the disease agents. And these white blood cells could be, well, the Hopi Native Americans call it the purifiers. And they reckon the purifiers are people. I don't know. It's just, it all gets very, very confusing and complex. But I'll close on the basic idea of Dr. John Lilly when he talked about his perception that the whales and dolphins are repeater stations for water-based life on other planets, that the signals of water-based life are weaker than that of the machine solid-state intelligence that's trying to use us to create it so it can take over here on the Earth, made of silicon rather than carbon. But that they're in touch with water-based life on other planets and other star systems, and that they are integral to maintaining the balance of life and the connection between Mother Ocean and water-based life. And I know that the connection of the whale-dreaming people of Australia are part of this same process. And this whole very, very deep connection, which I call the Cetacean, Keringi, Lawler, Lilly, Narby, Ricketts, Velikovsky, Klug, Napier, Alvarez hypothesis, where it ties together all these different things. This is central to my whole life, and when I return to Australia in about a month, I'm going to be engaging in a very major healing expedition, possibly to Mount Yango, but then to Three Hummock Island, Tasmania, possibly Flinders Island, the Bay of Fires again, Mount William, Apollo Bay on the Great Ocean Road, then Kata or Kangaroo Island, Victor Harbor, and Second Valley. Follow the Song Line up to the Flinders Range, St. Mary's Peak, Wilpena Pound, then to the Central Desert, Uluru, Katajuta, Attila, and Alice Springs. Hopefully do a mural for the YHA again there. Go to Darwin, the top end, Litchfield, Nipmuc, Kakadu, Arnhem Land. Go over to Broome, Darby, and Kununurra, and down to Equestro and Pernalulu or the Bungle Bungles. Then over to, I want to visit the Guion, the Bradshaw Rock Art in the Kimberley, which is very, very, very cosmic and quite remote, but it's, maybe I can reward myself after, in my 20th year of traveling in Australia, to finally make it to see the Bradshaw Rock Art. Then I'll go to Carrageenie, Hammersley, Chichester Mills Stream, Python Pool, Mount Bruce, Broome, Denham, Denmark, Dontre Castell. Cape Range, Exmouth, Kennedy Ranges, Mount Augustus. Carnarvon, Fremantle, Margaret River, Perth, Valley of the Giants, back across. It's going to be a fantastic trip. There's a lot of ground to cover, so I might not go to... I might fly directly to Hobart this time. And panspermia is another interesting idea. There's all kind of fish jumping out of the water here in front of me now. Panspermia is the idea that life came to Earth via asteroids or comets. It's a very, very, very interesting idea, and it ties in with Thomas Gold's idea of the subterranean microbes and the very dark idea of Dr. Frankensteel's idea of contaminating Mars with genetically modified organisms, which is just a heinous blasphemy flying in the face of Carl Sagan and anybody with any sense of responsibility and the sacredness of life. Anyway, life is self-organizing, homeostatic, cybernetic, capable of self-reproduction and healing and regeneration. And so I'd like to really focus and ask everybody to focus every possible ounce of consciousness and healing energy they can on the healing of Australia, of all my family of life, the koalas, the lyrebirds, the glossy black cockatoos, the forest owls, the boobooks, the powerful owls, the all these little marsupials like the anticlinus, and oh my God, and all the landscapes, and it's just horrific, and the extreme, really weird weather stuff, all these anomalous fires followed by now anomalous floods, first burning everything to a crisp and now washing it away. The most corrupt government Australia's ever had by light years. Anyway, I'm going to be gathering as much spiritual energy as I can in honoring Te Waipounamu, the beautiful South Island of New Zealand. I'm going to visit Grandmother Martini at Castle Hill and be here about another month before I probably fly to Hobart. Anyway, this is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off for On the Brink Radio. Keep it in the road. Live simply so that others may live. And remember, the only thing that's faster than light is simultaneity.
Good day. Mm-hmm.